I'm just like, yeah, you know what? We're going to split this bad boy in two because I saw something that I really want to deal with. I think would be of help to us before we get into the rest of the lesson. So we're just going to read verses 6, 7, and 8 out of 1 Samuel 22 here this evening. And the Bible says, when Saul heard that David was discovered and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. Then Saul said unto his servants, that stood about him, hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards, and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds, that all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse? And there is none of you that is sorry for me, or showeth unto me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. Now, the reason why I'm wanting to stop there is because you get into verse number 9, and now we're going to deal with Doeg and him turning over the information that he's got about David and the priest there at Nob being slaughtered and all that. I want to focus on these first three verses here, though, and just look at the jealousy of Saul and what all is being done here. So let's reread verse number 6. And we'll get through these three verses, and I'll show you what I'm going at after that. So verse number 6, when Saul heard that David was discovered and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. First things first, we don't have a clue how much time has actually passed since David had fled his home that night when they put the image in the bed and made it look like David was lying there in bed, and David runs for his life. And this moment here, few days, a few weeks, we don't know. Maybe a month. We just honestly can't say. But Saul has very much had time to stew about David getting away. He's very much had time to sit here and do the worst thing that anybody can do to themselves. Let themselves into their own mind. Because as you read through here, especially when you get down there to verse number 8, now Jonathan, his oldest son, the crown prince, is in cahoots with David. And you know what? Forget that. Jonathan has set this whole thing up with David. He's making arrangements for David to come in. Saul messed up bad by stopping to think to himself, not going in and trying to talk to anybody, not trying to get things right, nothing else. He has spent all of this time mad, all of this time thinking all the wrong things. And stupid thinking only hurts the stupid, and we make ourselves stupid by doing stupid thinking. It's a vicious cycle. Now, word has finally reached Saul that David is walking around openly in Judah. Yeah, he's kind of, you know, keeping where he actually is set up camp a secret. But if people have noticed he's there in Judah and reports have gotten back to Saul, yeah, he's not totally hiding. He's not walking around with the cloak pulled over his head real tight so you can't see him. And he's sneaking around corners in the dark and all this. David's moving about. But the word has also come back that David is beginning to build an army. David's intention was not to build an army. It was the people's intention to come to David and build an army. But David, he's getting stuck with the tag. The news of that army was going to further feed the fear of David preparing to attack him to take his throne. And something else, too, as I was reading through here, really reminded me of another individual that we're told about in the Bible who was very jealous for his throne to the point where he killed his own sons. And I'm talking about Herod the Great. Anybody who looked like they might would make a play for his throne, he had them killed. Man even had a hit list put together. When I die, these people are still alive. You're to kill them so that they cannot interfere with my chosen successor. And it's like he's emulating Saul here. Because this is the kind of thinking that Saul has got going on. Something else real quick too. We mentioned earlier the name of Orpha and Orpah, and Oprah, I mean, and something, I'll say it anyways because I already started down the path. Oprah made a statement years ago. The reason why that she doesn't do God anymore. Because she read in her Bible, she's raised Baptist, she read in her Bible that God said that I am a jealous God. And Oprah said, oh, get over yourself.
Oh, God. Okay.
Now, the reason why Oprah is wrong, we actually find that over in the book of Matthew when the chief priests bring Jesus to Pontius Pilate. And the Bible is very specific. It says that he saw for envy's sake that they did this. Envy is wanting something that someone else has that rightfully belongs to them. Jealousy is wanting something someone else has that rightfully belongs to you. So God says, I am a jealous God. He's saying, I deserve my glory. I deserve my honor. It is rightfully mine. We as human beings look at the word envy, look at the word jealousy, and we say, same word, interchangeable. But they're not. They're two different words beyond the spelling. One is, that's not mine, but I want it. The other one is, that is mine, and I do want it. Saul here, as I titled this, Jealousy of Saul. He's wanting what is no longer his. The throne has already been taken away from him. It's just a matter of God is waiting on his own timing to take it finally, I should say, from Saul. But Saul is going absolutely nuts here, going after David because he sees, hey, I want my throne. How dare you try to take my throne? David's not trying to take the throne, but that's how he is. All right, getting back here to our verse, there are a couple of Ramas in Israel. We all know of cities all across the United States. It's the same city in every state. You know, there's a Lebanon, Indiana. There's a Lebanon, Ohio. There's a Lebanon, Kentucky. That's one city in three different states. Rama, same thing. This Rama is not the same Rama that the prophet Samuel lived in. But perhaps Saul was liking being in this Rama because it's like, well, I can't actually be in that Rama where Samuel is because me and him were on the outs, but I can be in this Rama, so it's kind of like I'm over there. God doesn't work with cheap substitutes. He's not looking to do that. He likes the genuine article. And when we sit here trying to double deal and finagle things and we're going to work things out our way and by hook or by crook I'm going to do it, we're giving ourselves some cheap substitutes that aren't going to really work for us. Now, he's under this tree. The idea of being under this tree is because this is where he would hold open court. If he's there in the city, you know, they'll do that. They're in the gate of the city. Everybody's free to come in and judge. He's also got his palace with a throne room there and dignitary. He'd meet the dignitaries there. But when he's actually out there in the field, like a good leader should be, you know, he would meet under the tree to do judgment and all this other good stuff there. The men standing, let's see, I'm sorry again, don't forget the spear is a symbol of his power. It's kind of like a scepter. And being stuck into the ground so that it would be ready for him to reach down and grab at a moment's notice. But this would also keep his hands free so as that if he needed to reach for his drink or whatever, his hands are free. The men standing around would be a sort of war council. These are the guys that are the yes men for Saul. And, oh yeah, Saul, everything you say is good. You're nuts, but it's good, you know. Saul is simply trying to take advantage of the time to pour out his complaint to them instead of going to God and God alone. You know, the Bible says we're to cast all our cares upon him, for he careth for us. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor. We forget we need to go to God. Saul completely blew past that. Do things my own way. Verse 7. Then Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, Hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards, and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? So most of the men that are gathered around him, they're from his tribe, they're Benjamites, just like Saul is a Benjamite. As such, to Saul, it only seemed logical that these men, above anyone else, should be concerned about every aspect of Saul's welfare. Hey, y'all are my brothers. You're my tribe. So if anybody should be concerned with poor, pitiful me, Saul, it should be y'all. Why aren't you more concerned? And he's looking to arouse a sense of patriotism, their sense of loyalty to their king, to their own blood, to their tribe. Hey, y'all, don't you want me to win type thing here? That's what he's looking for. And Saul definitely, he understood how to reward somebody, how to use rewards. He will do it again. Talks here, hey, look, I will give you fields. I will give you vineyards. That means they're going to be landowners. Owning land, that is prime wealth. After land, you got animals. After animals, then you start getting into the gold and silver, so on and so forth down the line there. He says, hey, I will make you captains of thousands. I'll even promote you higher than that, make you a captain of 100. Can the son of Jesse do this? He didn't say, can David do this? No, because everybody liked David. They had respect for David. So by calling him the son of Jesse, he's trying to say, this poor, pitiful little dirt farmer, this shepherd, you really think this poor kid can do anything for you? I'm emphasizing the son of Jesse here to get it across to you. He ain't got nothing. Can't do it. Look at me, I'm king. I can do this. And how many times do we get that kind of an attitude in our minds? I can do this. I've got the money. I can do this. I'm in this position in life. I can. And what happened to that rich fool that said, I will tear down my barns and I will build bigger barns and I will bestow all my fruits and I will say unto my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And God says, thou fool, thy soul shall be required of thee this night. So we need to make sure that we're not focusing on I problems get us into lots of trouble. Even if David would become king, he's from the tribe of Judah. So chances of him giving fields or vineyards or olive yards and promoting to captain, promoting to general, any Benjamites? Pitiful. Probably non-existent, fellas. Come on, y'all know the score here. I'm the one who's going to take care of you. Jesse's his boy. Ain't going to do nothing for you. You need to be keeping this in mind. Now, Saul also pointed out that David's army was small, so there wouldn't be but a couple of high-ranking officers in it. And with that alone, he's already got his lieutenants and his captains. He doesn't need you. Okay? Also, if his army would grow to need more officers by this time, those ranks would already be being filled with men from his own tribe, just as Saul had done from his tribe. So they just weren't going to get the job unless they stayed with Saul and Saul stayed alive. Verse number 8, real quickly. that all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me, or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. Mm-hmm. So he's finally discovered that Jonathan wasn't the blind, loyal follower that he had taken him to be. And like I said, he's doing that stinking thinking. He's getting in here and he's like, oh, Jonathan this, Jonathan that. Jonathan, I got it. I figured it out how David's going to be able to do it with that small army. Jonathan has put him up to this, and Jonathan is going to take and unlock the front gate and march David's army in there and allow David to kill me in my sleep. Jonathan's going to open up the doors. That's what's going to happen. I've got it figured out. He says right here that my son has stirred up my servant against me. So now it's not even David who's doing this. Now he's pinning it all on his own firstborn son.
Because he's for David.
Because he's for David, and Saul is jealous for his throne. Saul's always been this way, though. We never covered it in the previous book because these books are about David. But I want you to turn back to chapter number 14. And we're going to hit a few highlights here in chapter 14 to just better illustrate why it is that I'm splitting this section off. In chapter number 14... we find that we've got another border skirmish going on here between the Israelites and the Philistines. So verse number 1. Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan the son of Saul said unto the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. See, Jonathan had gotten sick and tired of all the delay tactics from dear old dad. He understood Saul should have been making some military decisions here. Instead, Saul is just sitting idly by and every day griping and moaning and groaning when the report comes in. Yeah, we had 3 more deserters last night. Yeah, 10 more of our people disappeared overnight. Well, yeah, they're going and hiding into their hills and rocks and defecting to the Philistines and all that because they see Saul ain't doing nothing. Jonathan's sick and tired of it. He's sick and tired of nothing being done. So he decides, you know what? We're going to do something. Now, it's against military protocol for you to go and strike out on your own. Your ranking officer needs to be told what's going on. Now, he's the crown prince, so the only officer over him is the king. So he should have said, hey, Dad, you know what? You sit here nice and comfortably. I'm going to take my armor bearer over there, and we're going to kick their butts. He doesn't do this. He sneaks off. Why? Because he knows Saul ain't going to let him do it. Because he knows dear old Dad gets one whiff that he's going out there to try to get victory. Dear old dad's not going to be concerned that his son might get killed in battle. He's going to get concerned that there's glory not being given to him. Jonathan realizes this. This is not, we're not even going to tell my dad. Not going to worry about it. Come on, let's just go. He is acting in faith. Most likely, yeah, he's being stirred by the Holy Spirit to go and do this. There's something right here, Jonathan. Go do it. And Jonathan says, you know what? That's a great idea. I'm going to go do that. And we need in our lives, in the church's life, when the Lord laid something on our heart, we need to go for it. Now, make sure you've prayed that you are doing exactly what is it the Lord's wanting you to do and not what you're wanting to do. Because that, you know, what you're wanting to do, that's Saul. Okay, we don't want to be like Saul. We want to be like Jonathan. But the fact of the matter is, you're not going to get something resolved by sitting around doing absolutely nothing. Jonathan said, I think I can go over there and make a difference. I'm going to do it. We need to look and say, I think I can make a difference in this area. I want to go do this and see what God will do. God will honor faith like that a whole lot more than God will honor us sitting here holding down these chairs so they don't float away. Skip down to verse number 13. And Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him. Now, this is what's going on. Jonathan's going out there, and the garrison, they've spotted him. So, all right, you Israelites, there's two of you, come on up here. We're going to put you in your place. And Jonathan got out there. There's only two swords in all of Israel. One belongs to Saul, the other belongs to Jonathan. You look back there at verse number 21 of chapter 13. Any farming implements that would ever need to be sharpened, they literally would have to take those to the Philistines to have them sharpened because they were the only ones who had a blacksmith. The Philistines were making sure that they were able to bring all the money from Israel to them. And this was a form of weapon registration here in 13, verse number 21. We know who has what and how many you've got. So they know, hey, look, these Israelites, they're coming here. It's not like they're going to have much. You know, they've got a garden hoe with them. Maybe they've got a shovel. Like they're really going to take us out. Jonathan walks up there, says, shling, I got my sword. Starts hacking away. He's knocking these guys down wounded. Whatever instrument his armor bearer had, whether he had a garden hoe or whatever, he's killing right behind. Maybe he took the sword off the first guy or an axe or something, and he started using that to finish them off. Never let a fallen enemy live. Okay? You don't believe me? Ask Shaka Zulu about that back there in the 1800s. Only enemy that African warrior chief ever let live, came back to kill him a few years later. So there, this armor bearer says, okay, Jonathan's going forward. I don't want no one sneaking up behind us. You're dead. You're dead. You're dead. You were already dead. I made sure you're dead. We're going to go through and we're going to do the Lord's work. Let's make sure we get it done. If it's something that requires us, just the double back, make sure it's done. The double back, make sure it's done. Let's go forward for God. Okay, skip down to 21. Moreover, the Hebrews that were with the Philistines before that time, which went up with them into the camp from the country round about, even they also turned to be with the Israelites that were with Saul and Jonathan. So what we got going on here? Saul realized that while these bandwagon jumpers had joined his army in the fight and thus were following him, it was only because of what Jonathan had done. Saul did not like playing second fiddle to anybody. These guys, they've gone, they've joined the enemy. Now all of a sudden it's like, hey, you know what? I am an Israelite. I'm going to fight for the Israelites. We skip the part where the guys who were hiding in the mountains have come out and they've joined in the fight. All that Saul, as he's looking around, says, man, my army's swelling and it ain't because of me. These people are not actually following me. They're following Jonathan. Okay? Verse 22. Likewise, I thought I had already read that, but it's verse number 22. Likewise, all the men of Israel, which had hid themselves in Mount Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, even they also followed hard after them in the battle. I apologize, like I said. Hadn't gotten to it quite yet, but it was the next verse. These guys saw a very decisive, real man leading the charge like a real leader. He is winning. They liked it. They're following him, not the king. Verse 24. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged of mine enemies. So none of the people tasted any food. Now, why are we pausing right here? Glad you asked. Seems very reasonable that Saul is going to utter this command with this capital crime curse while he's still got control. When everybody is there and able to hear him, except the guy who's out there fighting the good fight. Jonathan's too far away. Jonathan's too busy killing the enemy. Now maybe this was even being said while Jonathan and the armor bearer had snuck off, and Saul's like, huh, we numbered Jonathan and his armor bearer aren't here. I know what that little rascal's up to. Before we go charging out there, this is what we're going to do. Fact of the matter is, however it's done, Jonathan was not here. We see that in verse number 27. Saul made sure to tell this when not every single one of his people was there. And I'm going somewhere. Now the thought would be to save time by not eating so that they could overtake the fleeing army. Because if you're not stopping for lunch, you keep on marching. Okay, you're supposedly making up ground. But this is going to prove to be self-defeating because an army marches on its stomach. They were too hungry to be able to keep up with the pace. The oath portion made a capital crime to eat anything. The people suddenly seeing such progress against the dreaded enemy, who had been plundering their lands, quickly reasoned that their king must know what he's doing. Okay, the kings gave that order. We will try it. We will do our absolute best. Thank God for people who will do their absolute best when they're told, hey, let's do this. Problem is, the person who gave this command was wrong. The oath denied them even partaking of anything as they're marching. So they couldn't even grab a sandwich, pick an apple off a tree, a bunch of grapes, the honey that we see here. Was it verse 27? They don't get to eat anything whatsoever, which defies common sense. They could have at least kept some strength up. It does no good whatsoever to march your own army to the point of utter exhaustion. Because even if they'd have caught up to the Philistines at that point, they wouldn't have had the strength to fight. If they caught up to the Philistines, chances are it's because the Philistines stopped to eat, which means they have gotten some nourishment in, some strength back, and now the slaughter is going to go the opposite way.
They had a little honey. Had a little bit of honey.
The only one who got that little bit of honey was Jonathan. And the rest could have had it, but that oath, okay, capital crime, punishable by death. Verse 30, Jonathan said, how much more if haply the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found, for had there not been now a much greater slaughter among the Philistines, Jonathan realized how his father's idea short-circuited his own plans. Verse 33, then they told Jonathan or Saul, saying, behold, the people sin against the Lord in that they eat with the blood, and he said, ye have transgressed, roll a great stone unto me this day. Saul is operating off of zeal and not faith. Zeal is a very good thing to have, but if it is not tempered with faith, it is not tempered with patience in serving the Lord, zeal will burn out quickly, and it'll burn you up in the process. And that's what Saul's doing right here. What little he's got left of following the Lord, he is burning through it quickly. Verse 35, and Saul built an altar unto the Lord. The same was the first altar that he built unto the Lord. Can we just go, amen? Oh, how pious he was for this. This was his first altar to the Lord. Why'd it take him so many years to build his first altar? Why is he building an altar to the Lord now? Because it's all a mask. He's not legitimate. He's a faker. He doesn't actually care. He has set a trap and he's about to spring it. Verse 36. And Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and spoil them until the morning light. You're going to march your army in the wilderness in the dark. You know what's going to happen. They're tired. They're hungry. Someone's going to say, there's a Philistine. And they're going to turn on one another and start killing each other. It happens. You think about there in World War II. The USS Indianapolis delivered one of the atomic bombs. And on the way back from delivering that atomic bomb, she got torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. I forget the exact number of sailors that survived the sinking, but they're there in the water. It's shark-infested water. They've been out there for a long time. No one knew about the Indianapolis. The mission was top secret. So no one had a clue that that ship had sunk. No one knew where she should be. None of this stuff. Well, after so long of being out there in the water, the men started yelling out, "There's a Jap! There's a Jap!" And they started turning on one another in the process. It happens. So here he is. He's wanting to go and do this. "And let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatsoever seemeth good unto thee." Then said the priest, "Let us draw near hither unto God." So we've got more zeal on display with no faith in action. Saul wanted to charge off into battle at night with no light to see. This could have led to the confusion of his own ranks. Perhaps that was the plan for Jonathan at this moment. In the confusion, Jonathan gets, accidentally killed. He doesn't have to go any further with this trap as he's got this backup trap that doesn't succeed because God doesn't talk to Saul. Verse 37, "And Saul asked counsel of God, 'Shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou deliver them into the hand of Israel?' But he answered him not that day." Why should God talk to someone who doesn't talk to him? Verse 40. "Then said he unto all Israel, 'Be ye on one side, and I and Jonathan my son will be on the other side.' And the people said unto Jonathan," or unto Saul, "'Do what seemeth good unto thee.'" Isn't it a little strange, the marked division that's put there? Me and my boy Jonathan, we're going to be on this side, and all of y'all are on that side. What if someone over on that side got took? Now they have to start dividing that up even more. Whereas if it's on this side, there's literally just the two of us, and Saul knows who's guilty. Because Saul knows Jonathan was not there, and even if he's heard from others not to eat, he's confident that Jonathan won't have heard about it until after he has taken a bite. And he knows a perfect lot will be given by God, if for nothing else, for God to put Saul in his place. But he knows it'll be a matter that Jonathan will end up being taken. He has set a trap for his own son. So to see back here in chapter number 22 that he's going to suddenly start accusing Jonathan of not only helping David, but to actually trying to orchestrate an assassination attempt on his own dad, it is not a far stretch at all. The man, he's beyond being jealous. He has lost it.
He's evil.
Yep. He definitely died without faith. Mm-hmm. So do we have any questions?
Well, he let his evilness take over him. You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's why
a whole lot of people have.
That happens today in our government and everything else.
Even in our own churches, we will take scripture and twist it to make it suit what we want. And amazing how much you can get away with when you've got it looking like, "Yay, the Lord hath said," when that's not exactly what God said. But we get that way. Anything else? All right. If not.